Hello and welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. My name's John Burns and this is my podcast for folk who like to be outdoors in Scotland, pretty well anywhere else that, for that matter. I used to be a member of the Cairngorm Mountain Rescue Team, and I can remember a few occasions we work with dogs a lot, and it's quite a fascinating sight to be walking in some blizzard somewhere and just see a dog take off and know where it's going when most of us really couldn't see a thing. It's a fascinating and a very ancient thing to work with dogs. So I'm pleased to say that my guest today is Paul Besley. He has just written a book, The Search, The Life of a Mountain Rescue Dog Team. And best thing to do is to start talking to Paul and find out what he's been up to. Hello, Paul, how are you?
I'm very well, John. Thank you for having me. It's blue skies and freezing cold here in Sheffield.
Oh, wow. Well, it's not quite that up here. I'm in Scotland, obviously. It's a bit grim, I think, is the word they'd use in Sheffield to describe the weather here. So how did you start to get into the hills yourself?
Oh, when I was 14 year old with a friend, we went walking. We walked from place called Crowden. The intention was to walk across Bleaklow and Kinder to Edale.
All right.
No map. Just a guidebook, which was a hand-drawn thing. We never stepped off tarmac.
Right.
We ended up asking the news agents directions to Edale. This was in Charlesworth, and he told us to walk back along the Woodhead, which, if you know that route, is a pretty dangerous route.
All right,
this was in summer and a storm hit, and we got to the youth hostel at Crowden again, but we weren't members, so we didn't think we could go in, so we hid in the telephone box outside.
Oh, right. Oh, my God.
And his dad came and picked us up, gave us the obligatory telling off, and then the next week, I think about this now, and about how our parents must have been. But the next weekend, we walked along the gritstone edges quite successfully in the Peak District.
Oh, right.
And that's how it started. And that was it. And so I've walked since I was 14. I'm 65 now, so I've been walking for 51 years. Well, obviously longer than that, but in the hills.
Yeah, yeah. And What sort of got you involved in rescue? You think you were rescued yourself at one point, I believe. Is that right?
I did. I fell off a mountain. Well, actually, it's a bit of a crag, but it sounds more dramatic if you say mountain. And I still to this day don't know what happened. There's a 30-minute period that is completely blank.
Right.
I remember stepping over a little stream. This is in the Lake District.
Right. Well, whereabouts Lake District? Because most people will be familiar.
The Leaver's Horse.
Oh, I don't even know where that is myself, to be honest.
So we're just coming off Coniston.
Ah, okay.
Going to Swale Howe.
Okay. So yeah. No,
my intention was to go down the Leaver's Horse path to Leaver's Water and then walk back down through Copper Mines to Holly Howe.
Yeah.
But there was it was Valentine's Day 2012, and there was a huge snow cornice over blocking the entrance to the path. So I came back and started to walk down Bryn Fell. And I remember stepping over a stream, and Bryn Fell's a bit like a football field. It's not shown grass by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a pretty wide open space. And half an hour later, I come round and I'm laid in snow in a boulder field.
Right.
And I don't know why. And I've got snow on my head, and I put my hand up to brush my hair, and my hand is bright red, and my scalp's been peeled back, and I can feel my skull. That's my skull I can feel. And I thought, oh, blast. Well, I didn't use that word, but I thought, I'm in a bit of trouble here. So my rucksack had come off in the fall, and it was about 30 metres below me. So I crawled down to it, called Police Mountain Rescue, the helicopter boys and everything, they got in touch with me, put my survival gear on, had some bit of coffee and some fruitcake, and waited for Coniston Mountain Rescue to come and pick me up. The interesting thing about it is I'd really smashed myself about. I'd clattered my way down the rock face, and so I got 8 broken ribs, broken leg, broken ankle, smashed shoulder, all the teeth in my mouth were smashed, and some were embedded in the roof of my mouth.
Right.
And this big hole in my head.
You didn't do it by halves, did you, by the sound of it?
No, but I don't remember any pain. And I crawled over a boulder field.
Right.
And I don't remember any pain. The only time that I became emotional, and I even did a resection. This is just before it's getting dark. I did a resection to give them my grid reference. And I gave them a 10-figure grid reference, which is just bonkers when you think about it.
Yeah.
And it's only when I finally saw the red jackets getting near me and the dog, I seem to remember a dog, that's when I let go and I started to sob. And then I was in and out of consciousness. Hypothermia was hitting me.
Yeah, yeah.
It took them about 3 hours to get me to stabilise me and get me off. The helicopter had arrived and that stayed up there for 3 hours.
Wow, really?
So it was quite traumatic. I ended up at Carlisle Hospital, an operation that night, and then one the next day. And my wife, while I was waiting for Mountain Rescue, my wife had phoned me up, because we were going out for a Valentine's meal that night.
Oh, right.
And I'm still thinking, before I've phoned Mountain Rescue, I'm still thinking, well, yeah, I could an hour down to Copper Mines, then an hour to Holyhow, then the car, and then home. This is what's going through my head. and she says, oh, how are you doing? And I says, oh, I'm just waiting for Mountain Rescue. And it didn't really register with me. She says, oh, all right, and I'll phone you back. So that was that. I'd left a route card.
Ah, right.
At Holyhow, with the time I was expected back, which was an hour and a quarter after I'd contacted Mountain Rescue. But
right.
But the guy at the manager, Philip Conway at Holyhow, did his job and phoned me in as missing.
Right.
At 5:15. And the police said, well, we've already got him, but thanks very much. So if I'd have been out unconscious all the time, he would have got me rescued.
All right, okay. But it sounds like you'd done it. It was textbook what you'd done, though, wasn't it?
Sorry?
It was textbook in that you'd left a route card, you'd worked it all out.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it was exceptionally windy. I've been scrambling up on Dow Crags. That's what I've been doing in the morning. So, you know, I'd spent a good day up there. Everything, and to this day, I still don't know what happened. I suspect I may have caught my crampon either on some piece of grass or whatever, or in my own clothing, and the wind has knocked me over, and I've just skittered over the edge.
Yeah, well, boulder fields in snow are particularly treacherous, aren't they?
Yes, but this was 100 feet above the boulder field. I hit the boulder field when I stopped falling.
Oh,
yes.
That was the good news, the boulder field, then, was it? Okay, blimey.
And here's the nice bit. I think about it. I'm very big for saying thank you. And it's always been part of me. So I wrote to the chief executive of the youth hostel.
Oh, right.
And told her what had happened. And the guy got an award for that.
Oh, brilliant.
Isn't that great? And I wrote and sent chocolates and flowers to the hospital. That was nice. Got a nice letter back from the surgeon, and I sent a donation to Coniston Mountain Rescue. The next day, Coniston turned up at Carlisle with all my gear and dropped it off. I wasn't aware of that, but so you know they'd gone even further than they were required to do. So I sent them a donation and a thank you. And Jeff Carroll, who was the treasurer then, who was actually on the job, phoned me up to thank me, and I said, look, I'm really sorry for all trouble I caused for getting you out on a night like that. I'm really very sorry. He says, oh, no. He says, you really smashed yourself up. It was a fantastic call out.
Oh, right. I'm surprised he didn't want you to do it again.
I know. And so
how did you yourself get into rescue then?
Well, because of that, it's a way of paying back.
I see.
It's a way of paying back. And it's the best.
Sorry, go on.
It's the best way I know of really saying thank you.
Yeah, and so what interested you in working with a dog and becoming a dog handler?
I'm not a big fan of people.
Right.
I'm very much a loner. Very much an introvert. Most of my working life, I've worked on my own.
Right.
And I'm very comfortable with that. I'm good in team things, and I'm, you know, I play my part. And when I became a full member, I was a donkey. I carried stuff up and carried it back down unused. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. I was really good at nav. Really good at nav. And I was good at search. You wouldn't put me on the end of a rope, particularly the end that was holding you. You just wouldn't do it.
Right.
I can do it. I can get by, but it is not my expertise. You know, I can do abseils. I can rig something up and everything. So long as somebody else checks it and I've done it all right, I'm fine.
Right.
Now, in Woodhead, crag rescues are few and far between, maybe a handful a month, a handful a year. If it was Edale, it's a handful a day sometimes. So it wasn't an issue. And I'd worked with a few dogs, and I just thought how they worked was just fantastic.
Yeah.
Firstly, they were away from everybody else, and there's a romanticization about it. It's, you know, it's you, the dog, against the landscape and the elements. And it is quite romantic. But also, it's on your toes, everything. So you're searching and you're given an area to search, and you've got to search that area and be able to stay with a good degree of certainty. Either there's nothing there, or I found something, or the dogs found something.
Yeah.
So I was quite drawn to that. But to be a dog handler, you've got to have been in mountain rescue a few years so that you know your way about on the hill in terms of within a rescue scenario.
Yeah.
And a search scenario. So you've got all the bits and pieces. You know, you're not going to be the liability because you're wandering into someone else's area or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got to be a dog's body for the search dogs, which is a fantastic thing to do. And it is the most important element in dog training. So a dog's body is a human being that will go out and hide for a day. Right.
Okay.
For dogs to find them. Or they will play with the dogs when the dogs are really young, as they start their training, to get them used to the what is called the find sequence, which is what you want your dog to do is you want your dog to detect scent, go and find the source of that scent, come back and tell you, and then take you to the scent. That's basically how it works.
So I mean, it strikes me as being a dog handler requires a hell of a lot of dedication because, I mean, obviously, I was in mountain rescue and, you know, you do some training for that. But when you're not training or out in a rescue, your time's your own, really. But with a dog, you can't turn a dog off, can you? They've got you've committed to them. How what's the process then of a, because I'm sure a lot of people be really interested in how you obviously you've got to build a relationship with the dog. And then you've got to go through all sort of different times of, of training to get to sort of tune into its sort of working instinct. What sort of process do you go through?
Well, it's all reward based. So, and it's all about enjoyment and fun. So the handler and the bodies have to be hyperactive, hypercamp. You really want to be doing this? Oh, that kind of thing. So the dog thinks, oh, this is fantastic. This is great. And you start off with obedience.
Right.
Sit, walk to lead, walk off a lead, lay down, and then lay down with me out of sight for 5 minutes.
Right.
And that's basic obedience. And then you do a stop test, which is your dog mustn't be attracted to livestock.
Yes. Okay.
You have to desensitize it in a way where the dog thinks, right, that's it, they're nothing to do with me now, unless my dad tells me I've got to move the sheep out of the way, then that's fine. Yeah. And they're tested. It's quite a stressful test. So you get a field of sheep and loads of handlers, and you get your dog, and you get all the sheep in the middle, and you stand up one side and your dog's at the other, and you call your dog, and it's got to come through the sheep and not vary in its direction to you straight away.
Yeah.
So that's the first one. The second one is you put the ball, each dog will have its own trigger. Scouts is a ball. It's a special ball he has.
Right.
There's nothing special about it, but he only ever sees it when he was training and working.
I see.
So that's put in the middle of the flock. He then has to go in, get it, and not be diverted by any of the sheep.
Right.
And then the third one is you put him in the middle of the field in a downstairs, so laying down, and then you run the whole herd over it. And he has to stay there. So that's the stock test,
he passed
with flying colours. And most do, but some don't. Some don't. You know, some get to that point and the dogs are too interested in sheep. It's generally the lone sheep that's having a nice resting chest-high bracken that the dog suddenly comes across and thinks, ooh, and the sheep legs it and the dog thinks, all right, game on. That's the danger one. But I videoed him the other day and we were walking through a field full of sheep and he took no notice of them. And the interesting thing is they take no notice of him. So they must know that they're safe.
Yeah. And how do you begin to introduce them to actually searching for people then?
So you start by getting a human being who has his trigger, whether it's food or toy, and they literally sit a few feet away from him, and you get him to engage with them, and the reward, when he engages, the reward is he gets a treat.
Right.
And gradually you extend the distance between dog and dog's body. And you keep doing that, and you do a variations of different things until eventually you can get him to find the person who is now hiding, come back to you, tell you, take you to the person, then they get the treat. And that's it. That is the fine. And the best, we used to go up to Aviemore every February.
Yes,
stay at the old Arctic training place at Badagoish.
Badagoish, yeah.
And we go up onto Cairngorm to do avalanche training. And we dig burial graves and put a body in it with all their clothes and everything. And they would have all the dog's toys. So it was quite popular, and they'd have a radio. And then we'd seal them in. And gradually, as the dogs got more aware of this body down there, we would sink the body deeper and deeper until about 2 meters deep.
Oh, right.
And that's a really good way, because what's happening is, as you're sat there now, we all smell the same. You've probably had your shower and you've got your Chanel number 5 on.
Uh-huh.
And I've got my Old Spice and I've had my shower and all that kind of stuff. But we all smell the same. To a dog, we smell the same. And the reason for that is that while you're sat there, you are shedding about 40,000 cells a minute of scent.
Right.
And that that gradually pulls around you. And the big ones are the head, the neck, the feet, the hands. They're the ones that will plume most of the scent. And these little scent cells will gather in rafts, and then they'll be picked up by currents, and they'll start to travel outwards in a triangle where the apex of the triangle is at the source, so as you. So it gets wider as it gets further away from you.
So presumably, if you're searching for someone, you try and start downwind, do you?
Yes. So that's the secret. So you want to be going, cutting across the wind, because it's coming down to you.
You're picking up the scents coming down the wind, basically.
Yes, yes. And so that's why dog handlers and dogs will operate on their own, because you want what we call a clean area. You don't want a whole raft of mountain rescue search parties clod up in their way, because it muddies the waters.
So you
have a clean area, and you walk scout perpendicular to the wind direction.
Right.
And at some point, he'll enter, hopefully, if the body is there, he'll enter that scent cone. And as soon as he does, his nose will snap into it and he'll be off.
Right.
And the scent cone has the outside of the triangle, it has the boundaries. So he will work between those boundaries, getting the strongest scent until he gets to the body. Scout's longest strike was 1,200 metres.
Really?
Which is a fair distance.
It is. That's a fair distance, yeah. Yeah.
And it's a thing to work, because at some point he will detach from me. He's not physically attached from me, but at some point he enters his own world and he becomes very... very determined. It doesn't matter what's in his way, whether it's a river, a rock, a cliff face, whatever it is, he will either go around it, go over it to get to the scent. And he'll keep doing that. He'll keep going to the scent and back to me, and he'll speak to me. He'll say, he'll bark, and that's his indication. And he'll keep doing that until I get to the source.
Right, that's what it interests me. I mean, one of the lines in your book I read, you obviously, you're a bit like me, you like being alone on the hill. I think you said, I used to think the best number was one, but now I realise it's one plus a dog.
Yes.
Is that still true?
Yes. Yeah, it is. And it's nice to work with people sometimes and stuff.
Yeah.
I like the solitude of the hills.
Yes.
And the great thing about Scout is, because he's so well trained, I don't have any issue with him off the lead. At lambing time, I'll put him on the lead, not because I'm fearful, but because I don't want the sheep or the farmers.
Yeah, somebody else would see you.
Exactly. So I'm more than happy with that. But out on the moors and everything. Now, I mean, I'm fortunate with Scout in that he likes bad weather and bad ground, bad terrain.
Oh, right.
Because, you get called out at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yes, you don't get called out in the nice weather, no.
No. You know, no one calls you out midday. It's a last-minute job. Oh, right, we better call them out.
And, exactly.
And it's generally crap weather and everything. And,
yes.
And you know, like I say in the book, everybody in mountain rescue is slightly out of step with the rest of society, because to get up in the middle of a night, in the middle of a winter storm, to go and look for somebody that you don't know and you're probably never going to meet, is not normal.
No, it's not. I haven't really thought about it like that, but I suppose you're right.
it's not normal. And so there's a certain kind of mindset that I think draws people to mountain rescue. Yeah. And it is that desire to help someone in distress.
Yeah.
Whether they've been helped or not is whether the member of the team has been helped or not is irrelevant. And I think that's a thread that runs through every single team.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's certainly a dedication, really, I think, for all mountain rescue teams. And you obviously realise that any rescue is incredibly a significant, important thing, you know. And let me ask you a bit about how do you think it sounds like quite a close relationship between you and the dog. I mean, you've got to develop tremendous trust and confidence in each other, because the dog has to be confident in you, presumably, does it? Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. And he has to, Scout has to know that he's pleasing me, but also I'm pleasing him. There was a point when Scout got to about 4 years old, so we were operational, and I realised that actually what had happened is our roles had swapped. He was now the leader. And I was his bag carrier, which is fine, you know. But I learned with Scout to say little is the best way, to just let him get on with it and to just give him bits of support now and again, you know, find him out and all this, or and rest him and things. But he began to then, there was a point where he started to pay attention to how I was. And that was quite a telling thing. So he took over, really. And he would do his own search on the landscape, and I was just there to carry the bag. I was there to ensure that we searched the landscape methodically and economically as well, so we didn't waste energy, so we could do another search in another area. So that was really my role. So once you've trained a dog the fine sequence, which is about 6 months, maybe to a year, the rest of the time, it takes about 3 years to train a dog team. The rest of the time is training the handler.
Right. Okay.
To be able to read the land, because things like forests, scent operates differently in forests. It operates differently, you know, in gullies, in rock outcrops, in boulders, in snow, in heat. So on a hot day, scent can be pulled from a valley bottom up onto the top and dump itself up there, but the body's right down at the bottom, and vice versa in the evening when the air starts to cool. So you have to learn all these things. So a Scout had two indications. There's the single bark where I found the body, get yourself here. And all he's bothered about is his reward. He's not bothered about the person that's laying there dying. He couldn't give a damn about them. He wants his reward. That's what he's doing it for. So it's really important that when you get there and the person is close to death, you ignore them and Scout gets his reward. So generally, and even if it's only for a minute, it's really important that, because that maintains the connection of what he's done. So generally, particularly for big areas, you would have a navigator with you, and they would be somebody that would be good at navigation, but also good at first aid and things. There'd be a cascade.
Right. And tell me a little bit of gave you the urge to write the book then? What was that like for you?
I started it in 2019.
Right.
I went to university to do a degree in creative writing.
Oh, right.
In 2017, several decades older than all the other students.
Yes.
I had to explain to them what it was like before mobile phones. And I used to say, it's really nice. It was really nice. so that was 2017. And in the second year, in 2019, I wrote a piece about the Chew Valley, which is where we used to train.
Right.
And it was 400 words. And I'd gone to see John at Vertebrate, who wanted me to do a day walk book for the South Pennines, which is a lovely area.
Yes.
Very, very nice. And as I'm walking out, I just handed him this 1.5 sides of landscape writing.
Right.
And by the time I got home, there was a contract there. And I thought, it's very nice. So that was 2019. And then I realized, so the book has taken on several different identities. It was originally called the Chew Road because where we trained in the Chew Valley, there's a road that goes all the way up from the bottom of the valley to the top. And it's probably the wildest area we have in the Peak District.
Okay.
And it's got really good names like Charnel Clough and Wilderness Gully, where an avalanche killed three climbers some years ago. And so it's a great landscape, and it can be very beautiful, but it will punish you. And in winter, while it can be beautiful, it can be absolutely lethal. So it's a good place. And so I started writing about the training and things.
Right.
And so then we, I started writing about it, and then 2020, the big thing happened, didn't it? COVID, lockdown.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you will remember, as soon as lockdown was finished, but everybody rushed out into the hills because they'd been watching YouTube for the last three months. And also during lockdown, people that had never walked before were suddenly walking, and so there were lots of call-outs.
But we
had to be fully encased so that we didn't catch any of the COVID masks and everything. And we all started coughing. Loads of us started coughing, and mine went on for quite a long time. And I went to the hospital in beginning of 21, and in November of that year, they told me what was wrong with me, and I've got asbestosis.
So I don't
have long left to live now.
Right.
So what happened during that time was Scout taught me how to live, because a dog is very much in the moment.
Yes.
So you know, he can have an argument with another dog, and then that's it, he's gone. Whereas, you know, me as a human being would be trunching about it for years, working out how I can set fire to his car without getting found out, that kind of stuff. So he let me that. But also what I was saying earlier, when that switch happened and Scout started to be the leader, he also started to watch me. I noticed he was watching me. This is before I found out about the asbestosis, which comes from my days in the steelworks. So he detected something in me, and he started waiting for me. So because I was slowing down on the hill, I knew something was going wrong, but I didn't know what it was. I thought I just needed to stop eating a few less McDonald's and things like that. But it wasn't that. And I noticed that. And anyway, when we found out the diagnosis and the prognosis, which was a year or two, the day before I was due to take Scout's upgrade, which is an assessment over 3 days where you have to prove that you've actually learned something in the 2 years and you become more efficient and you're quicker and all this kind of thing. And I did the first day, and my heart rate was above 200 the whole day, and that just wasn't sustainable. So I pulled out of the assessment, carried on, and then we did an exercise in the Peak District in in the storm in 2022 in February the 6th.
Right.
And I'd asked for two bodies to be put out. And so I knew I was looking for two people. And we found the first one. And the second one, I finished the area and I didn't find it. And I knew exactly where they were. And I knew where they, and I knew why I hadn't found it. And that was because I was exhausted and my head was mashed. It was in a storm, but my head was mashed. And at that point, I knew I was the liability on the hill. And so it was best we stood down. Bizarrely, I then decided to go and find this chap because I knew where he was. And Scout went, he set off and he came back to tell me he'd found. And he'd actually found a member of the public who'd been overwhelmed by the conditions, which were brutal, and was heading deep into hypothermia. So he'd actually had it ended with an absolutely top-notch find.
So that's amazing. What started out as an exercise became a real rescue. I've known that happen a few times, actually. And the good thing about it is you've got the rescue team right there just to start with, you know. I wanted to say a bit about your book, because I think what the book you create is exceptional. It's beautifully written, and it's a sort of matter-of-fact and a very humble, really, account of what you've done in the hills and your life. Does the writing of the book give you a certain amount of satisfaction?
Yes, it did. It changed very much over the time of writing. So it took 5 years to write.
Right, okay.
John had got a deadline of 2021. Well, that whizzed past with a whoosh. So
as they do.
as they do. because really, the book, the story changed.
Yeah.
And the reason why it ended up being called The Search is because as I'm writing it, I'm seeing the threads that are running through my life.
Yes.
And Scout is teaching me to live in the moment, particularly after we had the diagnosis.
Yes.
We decided we're just going to live in the moment now. We're just going to live today. Yeah. And we jettisoned all negative people and things. It was really ruthless because I don't have time for it now.
No.
And and Scout just gets on with his life. He just carries on. And so he's a really good example. But when he was taking care of me on the hill, it's only writing about it that I realised that that's what was happening. So in terms of the writing, it became a cathartic process.
Yes.
There were places in the book where I didn't want to go, and it took me a long time to go because there was a great deal of emotional pain.
Yeah.
Attached to it. And lots of, and I started to learn about the conditioning, my conditioning right from childhood, that dictates how I still react today. And that was a bit of a light bulb moment, really. And I'm fortunate in the care I get from the hospital is excellent. And in fact, on next Wednesday, I enter palliative care.
Right.
So that's a holistic approach. So that's both physical, but emotional, spiritual, and mental. So, but it also includes Alison, my partner, as well, because the impact on Alison is going to be huge. And it is now, but it will be greater, obviously, in a little while. So the thing is with Scout, and I think with most dogs, if you have a relationship with them, they know more about you than you know about yourself.
Very true, yeah.
And if you pay attention, they can teach you so much.
Yeah.
Just in living, really, in how to live right in this very moment. So I should be fully focused on talking to you, but one eye is on the decorator across the road, who's just come out to his van and stuff. So, you know, but in other terms, it's is they're not lying awake at night because of an argument I had with somebody 30 years ago.
Yes.
And I've just thought of the great punchline and all that kind. So it's letting go of all those kinds of things. But it's also about enjoying life, getting stuck in. We've been given the gift of knowing my time is extremely limited now. So go out and enjoy life and don't get involved in all the negative things. Stay away from negative people. Just swerve around them.
That sounds a great lesson for life. And I think I don't want people to get the impression that your book is at all, I want to use the word morbid or self-pity. It's not. It's a great book. It's beautifully written. It speaks, I think, of your love of the landscape and really this tremendous relationship that you developed with the dog and the great contribution you made. You know, it's very common, I think, for people who make huge dedicated service to other people that they're very self-effacing about what they do. And you come across like that. And I think what also comes across is the incredible courage with which you have faced, you know, a terminal diagnosis, which would be pretty damning, awful thing to happen to anybody. And I want also to say, you know, you... you talk in the book about the importance of saying thank you. That's an important thing for you. And I think what I'd like to do is to thank you for the huge amount of input that you've put into Marion Rescue in your life. And thank you for the dedication of what you've done, the enormous contribution that you've made. I'd like to recognise. So I hope you don't mind me saying thank you.
No, thank you. An acquaintance of mine who's no longer with us, he said at the end of his life, I think I've contributed, I hope I have. And I write that in the book. And I think that's the thing we can all wish for. And just to leave a little bit of us around somewhere is a sign of a life well lived, I think.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, and I'm sure you have absolutely contributed. Thanks very much, and not lovely to talk to you. Take care. Bye.
Take care. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks to Paul there for what I found a very moving and courageous interview, not only talking about his life in Marion Rescue, but coming to terms with, I suppose, the end of life. And I felt better for having done that interview, if that makes sense. I hope that you also found Paul's insights and observations on life interesting. I know that he is dedicated to his work in the Mountain Rescue. And if you'd like to donate to help the work that people like Paul do, which benefits all of us, really, I'll put a wee link on the page to Mountain Rescue in England and Wales, and hopefully some folk may feel able to donate to that. Thank you very much for listening. I've been John Burns, and I do hope you've enjoyed and found something worthwhile, as I have, in this interview. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.